Hello, listeners. Kathy Lawless, Life Story Curator. I'm all about capturing and curating career and life stories as a meaningful way to celebrate a milestone moment like a big old birthday, anniversary, retirement, or graduation. And I'm at my best when curating photo books that move your memories from the basement or your phone or your computer to the coffee table, giving you and your family and friends access to these treasured memories for years to come. I also love curating and capturing life and career stories through this podcast series, How Did I Get Here? It's a series of interviews designed for people just starting out in their careers, people in transition or possibly feeling stuck, and giving them access to the stories of people who have been there, done that, so that they might be inspired with some new ideas or maybe just comforted knowing they're not alone, that everybody starts somewhere and everybody goes through times of transition and times when they feel stuck.
Today, I'm very excited to be interviewing Susie Moss. Welcome, Susie.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Kathy.
And Susie and I have known each other through the Wise Woman group for what? Probably about 5 or so years now. Maybe it was when COVID is when we first kind of got connected together. So Anyway, listeners, Susie is the Regional Director of Development for the ADL Mountain States region. And ADL stands for the Anti-Defamation League. And we'll get to learn a little bit more about that. I know that's a mouthful. After we do the icebreakers, because, you know, we always like to start with the icebreakers. We're going to pause for a moment to hear from a very happy Life Story Curator client.
I'm a client of Life Story Curator, and I reached out to Kathy to do my husband's 50th birthday book. And I chose to use Kathy because I've seen her work and, of course, I've known her for a long time. And I knew that the product would be way above standard. I've done books myself, and I knew that she would do an exemplary job. The process working with Kathy is very organized, and we started off with interviewing me, coming up with a deeper analysis of who my husband is. And through that process, we came up with things I would never thought of on my own. With just her asking certain questions, it triggered memories and special things that really added a great deal of value when we went to put the book together. And I hadn't, again, I hadn't remembered all these things when I first talked to her about it. So having that interview was great. When my husband opened the book on his birthday, he was nervous, of course, at first, and then very excited and quite emotional. You know, that he's from New Zealand, and so having family represented from so far away in this book was really, really special. And I know that family and friends from afar were pleased to be able to be part of this process. And I couldn't have done, you know, half the job that Kathy did, particularly in the time frame. And it was just beautifully presented. And she captured him very well. And she helped me sort of narrow down the focus and the amount of photos. And it couldn't have been any better.
Susie, if you would, tell us where you grew up, what part of the country or world, and also a little bit about your family dynamics, what your birth order is, and how kind of both of those things, where you grew up, but also your birth order, shaped you as a person.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Midwest in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I am one of three children, and I'm the youngest. By kind of a long shot. So my sister is the next older, and she is 6 years older than me. My brother's 8 years older than me. And I was sort of, I think I was an oops. But my mother assures me that the best comes last.
Oh, okay. I love that. Yeah. I always love how the youngest describes themselves. I had one person say that she was told she was like a miracle or the gift. She believed that for about, you know, 14 years. And then she finally realized what that meant exactly.
Right.
Okay. So you're the youngest, you're in the Midwest. What did you all do for activities? Were you in sports or music, theater?
That is a really Good question. And the reason why I say that is because I have somewhat of a blurred childhood. I remember just being the youngest and having fun with my sister and brother, and I was sort of their playmate and their doll when we were growing up. My dad traveled a ton for work, and I didn't see him that much. And my mom did not work. She was schlepping us around to different places all the time, and she was very out there in the community, and we were constantly having play dates and going to swim parties and things like that. Something that's really influenced my life is at 7 years old, my dad, when I was 7 years old, my dad died in a car accident, and
Oh,
it
no.
changed and rocked my world and our family's world. But my mother was the most stoic, amazing person I ever knew, and she was incredible, but her stoicism sort of impacted me because I felt like I always had to be there. And she was this very, had her emotions in control, and I was the total opposite. And to this day, I'm a very emotional person. And so that influenced me and changed me. But shortly after, our dad died, and I really am struggling to remember a lot of those years, which is interesting. But my brother and sister went away to college because they were so much older, and it was my mom and me. And we were so close, just so close until she met, well, not until. And when she met her second husband, it was tough for me, but he was like my best friend. And that's just such a nice thing. And she had two wonderful men in her life. And so we were lucky for that. And you kind of look back and you wonder, is this, what would life have been like if it was different? And you can't assume, but you know that, and I'm a true believer that like things happen for a reason. And you can't maybe make sense of it, but my father's death and my mom's and my journey and with my stepfather and my siblings, it influenced everything about my life that you just don't count on.
Yeah, wow. So unpredictable and such a kind of crisis and tragedy at a young age. Wow. Okay. Okay. Well, and were you a good student? Did you like school? And were you into books and things like that?
You know, it's interesting. I wasn't a huge reader, and I don't think that I think my mom was so busy with three kids and my dad was traveling that I remember we sat down at night and read books, but I was not a big reader. I was a really good student, but I was one of those overachievers, and I really had to work hard at it. School was not my favorite thing, and I think I found as a very young age the way I got rewards and learnings out of things was by being involved and engaged. And I remember in school and in high school, I always joined the clubs. I wanted to be somebody that belonged, but I also wanted to be a leader. And I got so much out of those connections with people and my learnings through that. The biggest thing I did in high school was that I was one of the co-chairs of our yearbook, which was so much fun and just a blast. And it allowed me to be creative because I do have a creative side, but I'm much more of an analytical, achiever focused doer than I am that creative side of my brain. But it gave me that piece too, which was really fun.
Yeah, doing the yearbook, that would be a really fun project because you have to like interact with all the students. You have to know all the different activities and sports and different ways to put it all together. And oh wow. Now I'm
And
looking
it was
back only
funny because there
today.
was no technology to do that then. And
Oh yeah.
so it was really manual. And so it's been interesting over time to see how technology has changed that whole industry. This is a big, big industry. But it
Yeah.
just it I think at a time when I was struggling with my identity of being a child of a single mom, which was not very prevalent in the 60s. To be have a single parent, and my mom did an amazing job. but I still think I was trying to figure out how to find other things to give me joy. And that's sort of been one of the things I've done my whole life.
Yeah, which at that age, you're doing that anyway, but then you throw in the added dynamic of, you know, your mom being a single mom, like you said, which was so different. And then also that you were part of a family unit, a bigger family unit, but sister and brother gone. So now you're like only child, you know, not the community, but
yeah.
That, but you found your community, it sounds like, in some of these clubs and activities. So, okay, very cool. Well, we're going to come back to some of the leadership stuff here.
Okay, great.
When we go through your story, but shift gears just a little bit. Are you an introvert or an extrovert?
What do you think?
I'm like, I know the answer to this one.
Well, I am definitely an extrovert for sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we got that clarified.
Yeah, thank you.
On the fun meter scale of 1 to 5, 1 being a couch potato and 5 being the life of the party, where do you put yourself?
Well, I would say that prior to marrying my husband, I was definite 5. And I would say he's toned me down to maybe a 4. And I really have to push him to go and do things because he is very happy being home and reading, and I like to be out and about. So I enjoy having fun. Sometimes I really try to keep up with my adult children, which I'm not sure is good or bad for them, but all they have to do is say, come on, and twist my arm.
You get the invitation, maybe even invite yourself at times, right?
Right. I mean, I really, really want to participate in the Wise Women golf events, but every time I sign up, it rains. So maybe I need to stop signing up.
Yeah, well, it's not just you. I got rained out the other night too. So, okay, on the risk meter scale, same scale, 1 to 5, 1 being low risk taker, 5 being high risk taker. How are you on making, or how are you on risk decisions?
I think that I'm a 4. I mean, I would say that I move into challenging times, thinking about what I can do differently and taking a risk. But I think that has changed dramatically as I've gotten older and as I've gotten more experience. And I'm sure that's true pretty much of everybody. But at this point in my life and my career, I'm sort of standing my ground and I'm willing to take risks and I am open about, and I'm talking about it more professionally than maybe personally. But that too. And I think that it's changed. But I feel like if you don't take risks, you don't know what the possibilities and the challenges are. And my husband and I took a huge risk and we dropped out of corporate America about 20 years ago and bought a franchise in interior design and home furnishings. And that was a huge, huge risk. And we're still paying for some of that, even though the journey was only about 5 years. But we're glad we did, because it's changed where we are now, or who knows?
Yeah. And that would have always been out there as, what if we had, and then so you did it. And then now you have that learning and that experience. Okay. Well, Susie, let's get into what it's like to be the regional director of the ADL. And then we'll get into, did I get here? So tell us what you do as a regional director of development and a little bit about the Anti-Defamation League.
So the Anti-Defamation League has been around for 110 years. It's a national organization that started in 1913. And the focus and the mission statement then is the same as it is now. And the mission statement is to stop the defamation of the Jewish people, or in today's words, anti-Semitism, and to secure justice and fair treatment for all. And that is so important because the Jewish population, I am Jewish, but not everybody that works at the ADL is Jewish. It's more of a civil rights organization, and the focus is on fighting anti-Semitism, hate, bigotry, and extremism. But the way that the Jewish community and the philosophy of Jewish people is that we're such a small percentage of the world, and that other marginalized people are discriminated against as well. And so if we're not supporting them, then how can we really expect to support ourselves? And that's just really a Jewish value. And so everything we do has that lens. There's three roles that the Anti-Defamation League really has. One is to investigate, and that is to investigate places where people are discriminated against, where there is hate, where there is bigotry, where there's extremism. And the next piece is to educate those that understand it, but those that don't. And so the way we do that is we have a nationwide program called No Place for Hate, which is an anti-bias, anti-bullying training in K through 12 schools across the nation. And across the nation, we've probably touched just this last year, 1.8 million students. And in Colorado alone, about 80,000.
Wow.
And so this program is, you know, it does not have a religious bent to it. It is a programmatic framework for schools to change their culture around bullying and about acceptance. And so that's really important. And the reason why I bring that up first is it really drew me into ADL. And I was a board member before I was a staff member. I came on board because I was asked when I was working in another job if I would sit on their board. And I just loved the work we were doing in K through 12 schools because I do believe that these kids have, you know, are thinking critically and learning to act with empathy and kind of being their own people and not just regurgitating what they hear at home. So that we do education around that. We do education around Holocaust and genocide. We now have a Holocaust and Genocide Studies bill that Governor Polis signed a few years ago, and it'll go into effect in K through 12 public schools starting this next year in 23-24. That requires every student graduating from a public high school to have received training in genocide and Holocaust studies.
And we also,
yes, thank you. And we also do a lot of education for Jewish students that are trying to figure out how to navigate a world, both in high school and college, where there's a lot of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, wow.
And then we advocate. So we work with law enforcement and we train law enforcement on anti-bias and bullying training that we do some of in the school systems. We take that to corporations. So it's a whole realm. So it's investigate and educate and advocate. Now, what do I do there? My job is as a development executive is to secure financial resources so that we can do the work we do. So I'm basically head of fundraising for our region. And our region is Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming. And we have 25 regional offices like ours across the country, and the headquarters is in New York City.
Oh, wow.
That's great. A long answer to your question, but it gives both a little bit of background on the organization and what I do. So I work with donors that are individuals, corporations, foundations. We don't really get state or government funds, but I work with individuals that are passionate about our mission, that want to make a change, that are civil rights minded, and I match their passion and their needs to contribute in the community to what needs we have and the programmatic things that we're doing.
Wow. Well, thank you for the important work that this organization has been doing for over 100 years. I mean, that is impressive. Well, it's impressive, but it's also sad that we still need the Anti-Defamation League at the same time. So
we'd like to sell ourselves out of a job.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the mission is more critical now than it's ever been.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were a young person, junior high school, we know you were doing some of the fun activities of your school, but did you always think you would either be like a development person, a director of development, or that you'd be working for a nonprofit and a cause like this? Or what did you want to be when you grew up?
You know, it's funny. I have two children. My daughter knew exactly what she wanted to do at age 10. And our son, not so much. And I think I'm a good combination of them, but my son and I are more alike than my daughter and I. And I really didn't know, but I knew at an early age, and maybe again, going back to my dad, that I needed to be an engager and a connector. And I needed to belong to something, but not just be a follower, be a leader. And my dad was in sales. And so it became pretty clear. And nobody said, oh, you're just like your dad, you should go into sales. But it's just the track I took. And I didn't realize it until I was in college that I really wanted to be in sales. And I was good at it because it was more to me about the relationship with the individual or the organization than it was about the money I was trying to extract from them. And I carry that through today to development.
Yeah. And being an extrovert, I'm sure you liked connecting with people, and then sales could be that natural progression in. So then when did you go to college then, and did you have a particular major that was maybe just business then, or?
Yes. And it's funny how I got there, if I can just take a
Oh,
step back.
sure.
When my mother married my stepfather, he was really into fly fishing. And he had an old family. He was quite a bit older than my mom. And when they got married, my stepfather was always going fishing. And my mother at age 43 did not want to have this new marriage and then be stuck at home when he went fishing for 2, 3 weeks at a time. So she took it up. And I had to go with her when she was 43 years old and I was 13 to go buy her first pair of blue jeans. And
Oh.
that was such a memorable experience. I can remember it so well because she was going to go on this fishing trip and she had never fished. She had never camped, even though she sent myself and my brother and sister away to summer camp. She had never been to camp. My dad had, but she had not. And she hadn't ever gone to the bathroom in the woods. So I'd been to camp and I loved camp and I was in the outdoors, but not quite yet. And then they decided that they were going to see if I would fall in love with the West. And so they did. They sent me on a teen tour out West. We flew into Denver and we spent 6 weeks here. And in those days, the teen tours were going to hotel and things like that. I went on the teen tour where we were in a 15-passenger van with 14 kids and a counselor. And we climbed the Grand Tetons and we floated the Green River and we went horseback riding and packing in the San Juans. And I came to Boulder, which was my second stop, and I said, this is where I want to be. And that the rest is history. I've been in Colorado ever since.
Wow, very cool. So how did that so you were this is how you got to Colorado. How did you get into the sales then?
Right.
Did you end up at college then in Boulder?
Yep,
Is
I
that
went to CU Boulder and I got a degree in business, as you had asked, yes. And because I wasn't really that good of a, I mean, I was a decent student, but it was really hard for me. And so the way that I kind of balanced that was getting involved. And so I joined a sorority. I was in the Tri Delta sorority at CU Boulder. I joined the yearbook group and I got paid to do that. And then the thing that really influenced my career was that I joined an organization through the business school, through the international department at the business school. And it wasn't Leeds yet at the time, it was much smaller. An international organization called AISEC, AIESEC. It's a French acronym and it's basically an association for students in business and commerce. And what that organization does is it secures internships for people from other countries to come to your university and be hosted by your university, but work for a business for 2 months in the summer to a year-long program. And then for as many of these internships that you could find in your local community, you could send that many people from your college community on an internship somewhere else. And in the day, it was all hand matched. It wasn't even computer matched. So, if you speak a foreign language, they match you, whatever. But then, so there's two pieces to this organization. One is sales to go to these organizations like IBM that was in Longmont and or Niwot and say, okay, would you be interested in taking intern, and is that intern going to come from Germany or Spain or the UK or whatever? And then once the interns came to be the host committee that would make their experience in the United States and in Colorado something extra special. So I got involved in sales by doing that, and I became on the management team for that. There was the sales part, and then there was a hospitality side, which I love to be hospitable. Hey, I'm a Jewish mother, so of course I'm going to be hospitable. But then because I was involved in college when I graduated, I went to Sweden for 4 months for an internship.
Well, I was going to be my next question, which was then, did you get to travel? And did
I
you
did.
Get to partake in the other? Oh, how cool is that?
Yep.
So was that one of the reasons that you were interested, or just because all of that is what interested you to join that organization?
I really liked my professor in the business school that was the staff liaison.
Mm.
And I got engaged. It wasn't so much about the travel at that time. It was a way to belong and get engaged. And I don't do things lightly. If I'm going to dip my toe in, I'm going to be active.
I do love how you were connected to a professor, and I can't tell how many people I've interviewed that same thing happened. They went down a path either for a major or something they thought they were good at. Found out that maybe they weren't as good as everybody else was, or it wasn't, you know, really exciting them. But then they run into some sort of professor that really just lights them up. And then they recognize that, you know, that's kind of like when you find that great boss, or when you have that great connection at work, you know, that great boss can make an organization or a job that's not that great more great, or a bad boss, you know, can make something that's pretty great not so great. So
I've had both. Yes.
People you're around are very important, right? Who you work with.
If I look at that for my kids too. The teachers they have either made or destroyed their educational experiences. And that's probably a whole nother story of something I'm advocating for based on some issues I had with my son, but to be continued on that, because that's probably a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That those that influenced us both positively and negatively, right, in terms of our lives. So, okay. So now you go to Sweden, you said. So how was that experience? That
amazing. It was amazing. It was talk about risk and guts. I mean, I look at what I did now. Then, oh my gosh, there were no cell phones. You know, I traveled all over Europe with a girlfriend for about 8 weeks, and then my last stay was somebody I knew from this organization because it was national, and somebody that I had gotten to know from Stanford was in Helsinki, Finland, and so I went and got together with them for a few days, and then I took the train up the coast of Finland and went across the Gulf of Bothnia to get to a small university town called Umeå, U-M-E-A with an umlaut on it, Sweden, which is where the university was that matched me, if you will. So I went there, and it was a little disappointing, Kathy, because, well, let's go back. Sorry. I get off the boat. First of all, it was a tugboat, and people were covered from head to toe with tattoos, and they were all men. And I was a little nervous and scared. I mean, this was really before tattoos were a big thing.
Yeah, a big cool thing. They were kind of a scary thing, yeah.
I go and I get off the boat and I tell them, there's nobody there to meet me. There's nobody there to greet me. And here I am with these guys. And I just look back and I go, oh my goodness, what was I thinking? And I found out that I had put on my application that I was coming in at 5 p.m. And to them, that's 1700 because of the military time. And so there was someone there to meet me. So I went and I got to the payphone and I called up the family of the person I was supposed to be with. And the mother that answered the phone didn't speak English.
I was just going to say, do you even speak the language? You know, here you are embarking now on this internship.
No.
And oh, wow.
No. And that was one thing they didn't do, is they didn't prepare you with language or anything like that. But I didn't speak a language, so they sent me to a country that spoke English. So long and short of it, they found me where I was being matched to, and I didn't know this, was about an hour and a half south of where the university was. So that was unique because I didn't have the ability to engage with the students on a regular basis because I wasn't physically there. So they put me up in
Oh.
an apartment and I made friends in the town and I was sort of the American. They did not want to teach me Swedish because they wanted to practice their English.
Oh, well, that's cool then, that.
It was so cool. And I have such fond memories. And I kept in touch with a lot of those people for a while. But I'd kind of like to go back. That would be something I'd really like to do. But this was like almost like on a parallel of Anchorage, Alaska, like the Arctic Circle. It was way out there.
Oh man, so were you dressed properly at least and
Oh,
knew?
yeah. But then I realized, oh, I'm in Sweden. I need to go buy a fur coat. So I went down to Stockholm and my mother treated me to my graduation gift, which was a fur coat, which
Wow.
it was a memorable experience. But when you think of, I mean, one of the main things I remember is on Thanksgiving Day, I'm sitting at my desk at work and it was 10 o'clock in the morning and it was totally dark because it only got dark a light for like an hour. And I'm talking to my family and they're eating Thanksgiving dinner and I'm sitting here in the dark. But then I went to lunch and I had a beer at lunch because that's what they do. I mean, it was just an amazing, and that's where I found a love of hockey because they have hockey teams for their companies. It was just a unique experience, and I have not been back since. And so I really want to go back there and see if I can find any of the people that I once knew.
Yeah, because it was such an impactful time of your life, or it will influence you in so many ways, right? Wow.
So many stories, Kathy. I don't know how you narrow all these down in your podcasts and your work because there were so many
Well,
stories.
this is what's so cool is that, I know you and I know a little bit about your background, but I never knew that part. And what a great experience. And then you were part of that same experience then for probably dozens or so people that came over to the United States and had that similar kind of, well, this is what I did. I went to the United States and I did this thing in Colorado and wow.
So one
Wow.
thing that was so interesting that was sort of a downer, but it was cool, is in the United States, we took on interns from other countries because we wanted their knowledge, we wanted the generosity of bringing people in, but we wanted their knowledge base when we brought them in, or we needed their language skills or whatever. The main motivation in Sweden to bring these students over is so that they can send one of their own. So when I got there, they didn't know what they were going to do with me.
Oh, I see. So it was just a kind of this, oh, well, we need to do this so that we can send someone over there. And then they're like, oh, so we need to find her a job.
And
Oh, no.
so, but they found me a job in a company. But again, all they wanted to do was to practice their English. And they were the nicest, most wonderful people. And I just wish I had gone back and seen them sooner. But that was such a big deal for me to go do this big trip and everything. But so they put me in my least favorite place, accounting.
Ah.
No, I mean, I think I got a D in accounting. I think I almost failed it. I mean, I love numbers and I'm really technically oriented. So when they put me in accounting, what I ended up doing is working with them to figure out how to run reports on their tech stuff. And they were not tech savvy. And I remember in the day it was like a teletext. And so I just was very tech minded. And so I kind of created my own job there. And then when I left there, I was so close to securing a job with Prime Computer in Stockholm. And they were working on my green card and they sold a computer system to the Swedish Defense Bureau and they said, no can do. And I came back to Colorado.
Oh man, well, like, yeah, again, another one of those. If that had come through, what would that have changed in
Oh, I know.
your journey and your life story?
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay. So you come back to Colorado, and then now you've got this great experience behind you. What are you thinking? Are you living by yourself and just finding a job to get by, or did you find a new job right away, or?
Well, it's funny because I said I came back to Colorado. I actually didn't. I came back to Cincinnati because I graduated, and so I was looking for a job. What I really wanted to do is I wanted to go into advertising, and I don't know why. I just wanted to go, and I think it was because of the pitch side of it, not necessarily the creative side. That was sort of my dream. So I was kind of, my sister lived in Chicago, big, business for advertising. My brother lived in Atlanta, and I kind of went there for a couple weeks to look for jobs, and it just wasn't clicking. And so I said, I'm going back to college. And because of my tech experience in Sweden, and because of a market research course I had in the business school, we had to do a practical, I'm blanking on the word, Kathy, like it was a project, if you will, for our class. It was, the whole class was about this market research project, and we did it for a computer company in Boulder. Well, I decided I wanted to go back, since I knew the executives there from the study that we did, I wanted to go work for them. And I sold myself for 3 months, and finally, I'll never forget, I'm in the office waiting to get the interview for my very first job out of college, big job out of college. And they got an emergency call, and the executive left. And I'm sitting there twiddling my thumbs for like an hour, and I was getting ready to leave, and he comes back and he said, you know what? We are too busy. We have some stuff that's come up. But you have been pursuing us for 3 months, and if that's the way you are as a person, we want you to be on our sales team. And he says, I'm going to wave my wand and you're a salesperson, but don't ever tell anybody that I said that. And they put me through a 2-month associate sales representative training program, and the rest is history. I did sales for 25 years before my husband and I decided to leave corporate America and start our own business, which lasted about 5 years. And I said, what can I do now? And I moved my sales skills to fundraising.
Oh, okay. So tell us a little bit about the decision to start your own business and leave corporate. I mean, it sounds like I think that time frame, you spent 25 years, so you're kind of ready maybe to step for something totally new, right? But what was really kind of the driving force there? And I know we're fast forwarding a little bit, but
yeah, no, that's fine. So our kids at the time, our oldest was 10 and our youngest was 7. And I think we were both traveling so much for work. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we had au pairs that lived with us, which is a whole nother podcast, because I have so many stories about parenting au pairs, but way before I was ready for teenagers. So they lived with us and we were just done. And our au pair that we had that we loved was going to get married and we weren't going to do it anymore. And the kids were going to go to, the oldest was going to go to middle school. We decided we were tired of corporate America. And it was really more my husband than me. And I was working for IBM at the time that we bought this franchise. He had his whole mix of what was most important to him and what was the ideal job. And looking back on it, what he's doing now, and we can talk about that another time, what he's doing now fit the bill more than what we did.
Ah,
it was
okay.
Very expensive, but he wanted to offer services to people and engage with people. And so we bought a franchise in interior design and home furnishings, which neither one of us knew anything about. Nothing. I had an eye for it, but I wouldn't say I'm an interior designer by any stretch of the imagination. So we went and we had the interview with the franchisor in Chicago. And they said, we want business people. My husband was the business person. He had been an engineer. He's an analytical type. He could run the business. I was going to do marketing and training and the sales side of it. So we did that. And I decided I was going to stay working for at least another year while I got the business going. And I went to New Orleans for a conference with my all-male team that were working 24/7. And I had a few too many hurricanes in New Orleans. And I woke up the next morning with the worst hangover I've ever had and called HR and said, life is too short, I need a leave of absence. And that was the end of it. I never went back.
Oh, wow.
I never went back to corporate after that. Yeah. So I think sometimes things have to get tough before you say, okay, I'm at the bottom of the barrel and I need to be there for my family. And so I did.
Yeah.
That was a risk. That was a huge risk. We didn't have any income, but we had done pretty well in the tech world, both of us. So
Yeah, and you knew you were successful business people, and that's probably what they, again, they said that's what they were looking for. So you're like, this is great, because probably what they get are more interior designers. They get the people that are good at the actual doing the work, not people who are good at doing the business side. And what you need is a combination of all of that in order to have successful. Okay, wow. Well, and then sometimes you also have to take a risk and try something and go, now I know, oh, that wasn't it. Like you said, your husband now has landed where he should be. You have landed where you want to be, right? So
You never know.
you
We hadn't
have to
done
take
that,
steps.
would have been different. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so true also what they say about the hamster wheel. When you're on it, it's so easy to just stay on it.
Oh,
And
yeah.
you're just conditioned to that's what you need to be doing. And then of course then there's the handcuffs with bonus packages and comp plans and all
Oh,
those
yeah.
things too
You know.
that also make it harder to leave.
And your company
So.
was my clients, right?
So, okay, so you then you decide that you need to give up your small business. I'm guessing that was not an easy transition, and that was a really tough discussion and decision to get to, right?
We actually were in a mastermind group that really supported us through that. I think that made all the difference in the world. It gave us the courage to do the hard thing, which was to, we tried to sell it, but it was 2008 when we realized we weren't going to go into our retirement funds. We had invested a lot, which we knew we were going to have to in a new business, and we didn't have any expectations that we were going to, click our fingers and it was going to happen. So we were patient and we had planned, but then the hiring was the biggest issue. We could not hire enough of the right people. It was impossible. It was an HR nightmare. And being an HR, we probably should talk about that another time, but so that was really tough. And then we just decided to walk away, and it was really stressful. And my mother became very ill that last year when we decided we were going to close the business. And because we were closing the business down, Terry was able to take care of things at home. And I spent the last 3 months of my mother's life pretty much full time there with her, which is a gift I could never get back.
Wow. Yeah. So back to everything happens for a reason, right? That you needed to have something you could take the amount of time that you needed for serious, important life stuff that needed your attention. Well,
Absolutely.
Susie, I could keep going all afternoon with you here, but we do need to start
I
wrapping
know.
up. So how did you get then? So then you come back from your mom and spending all that time together. Then that's when you went into nonprofit space then? And
Not
then that's how
really.
you got into fundraising here.
Just real quick, I did some other entrepreneurial things. I was in network marketing.
Oh.
And so I worked for Sopata Designs, the jewelry company. I got it on today. I still wear it because I have so much jewelry. And I had been inspired by somebody that took the business of direct sales and moved it to a nonprofit space, but it really wasn't the shape or form of what you do when you're doing direct marketing. But it worked for me. I didn't make a lot of money, but I found my passion. And so what I started doing is I started doing something that I was calling Cool Jewels for the Cause. So I used the jewelry and the company I was working for. And when I would do these home parties, I would have the hostess pick a charity and I'd donate part of my commission. So I wasn't making that much and I was giving so much of it away. My husband's going, oh, what are you doing?
Susie, wasn't working
And
either, but it was kind
honestly,
of working.
but honestly, I did that. I started that business so that I would stay married. And I know that sounds crazy, but my husband doesn't do well in job transitions. And it took him 2 years to go from our small business to what he's doing now, which is he's an auto broker for HM Brown, and it's been perfect for him for the last 15 years. But I knew that if I wasn't working, I would be so stressed about the money and managing his job search. And so I just needed to do something to keep myself busy. And I found out I was really good at it, sales, but it was the segue to the nonprofit industry. And then the big way that I got into nonprofit is a family friend sold the business and became a philanthropist and said, look what you're doing in these small groups. I want to give this nonprofit money to hire you to help them with their corporate giving. And so I did that, and I did my own consulting for 3 or 4 years. And then I got recruited to go to the Museum of Nature and Science on their fundraising team, which was good, but it wasn't the end all be all for me. And I wasn't making what I wanted, and I didn't have the autonomy. And then finally, my good friend, who's the regional director of ADL, called me up and said, I want to take you off the board. And I said, what did I do wrong? And he said, we want you to consider this position for staff because we had somebody that unexpectedly retired and you'd be interested. And I said, twist my arm. It was a 40% pay increase. It was the job that I really hoped I'd end my career on. When I looked at the trajectory, I had taken that dip after I got out of corporate America, and I wasn't satisfied where I was. And this has brought me joy in the work I'm doing, in the people I'm working with, in the community, and I feel like I'm being paid what I'm worth for the talent that I've pulled together over the years.
And you're making such a big difference in the world. I mean, it's so cool about your story too, is you came over as a board member, which I know many of those board members, that's not a paid gig, right? You probably paid, you pay to play in a lot of these nonprofits.
I was a philanthropist myself, and I still am.
So you follow your passion, and that's the work you want to be in and doing and making a difference. And then now you're actually earning a living and making an even bigger difference because now you can bring funding to that and your time and talent. Wow. Very cool.
I think one of the things that maybe sets me apart is when I sit down with a donor, I say, I'm a donor too. I was a donor before I was a staff person, and I continue to be a donor to this organization and many others. And so that's kind of what I want to be known for, is a philanthropist. I mean, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I'd give most of it away.
Yeah, wow. So cool. Well, Susie, again, I could keep going, but we do need to wrap up. I know you have a hard stop here coming up. So I do have two closing questions.
Yes.
The first is, when you look back at your career, what do you think served you best? You know, a habit, a discipline, a character trait?
My gut instincts.
Ah.
I think that if I think about some of the transitions where I had angst, and not, there's good angst and bad angst. I mean, there's risk taking and excitement, and there's angst. And when you have angst and you do something different than what you're, when I took the last job at IBM, that's a whole other, I had a great mentor, but then we sold ourselves out of the job. We sold an outsourcing contract and we didn't have a job. My last job at IBM, I took and it didn't meet any of the criteria that I needed. I was taken away from my family. I was working all the time, blah, blah, blah. I never should have taken that job, but my gut tells me I shouldn't have taken that job, but I did. And you figure out I figured out what to do with it, and it served me well. But we have lots of issues with our children. My gut as a mom told me what was right, and thank God I made action on those gut instincts. So that's for me. That.
So it sounds like maybe that hurricane night also affected the gut in a way that you're like, I got to get out of here. So
totally.
Okay. And then last closing question then is any words of wisdom that impacted you when you were maybe going through times of transition or when you felt stuck, something maybe got you out of a funk, or maybe something you used to get your own self out of a funk, or your kids or your colleagues.
There are so many things that I could say. I want to recognize my mom, because, and this doesn't answer your question, but it's sort of how I live my life, but it's do unto others as you would have others do to you. And sometimes my standards are so high that I expect too much of other people, but that has been sort of my motto. But the thing that has really helped me is realizing, whether it's personally, professionally, when I'm at a bad point in my life, you need to ask for help, because other people don't necessarily know you need it. And every step of the way, whether it be mental health or problems with our children, or needing a business coach, or asking for advice. It is just something that I have made a part of my life that I am not feeling bad for asking for help. And I think that's helped me through all of these transitions. And maybe my mom didn't do enough of that when I was younger because it took me a lot longer to get help dealing with my father's death, coming back to sort of the beginning. It was my father, my stepfather, that said, you know, somebody else might be able to help you. And that was a gift he gave me. He gave me the courage to say, I don't need to do this on my own.
Wow. Well, there's some words of wisdom right there, right? Maybe somebody else could help. You know, because sometimes you don't even know, not only do you might be embarrassed to ask, but you don't even know what to ask for. I know when I was in a situation, I didn't even know. You're just so caught, kind of overwhelmed and maybe in a spiraling down situation. It is hard to know
You don't know
what
what to
to
ask
ask
for.
for. But it starts with just phone conversation and maybe just reaching out and being open and talking to other people. And you'll find, it just starts to either come out of you or come out of them, and then things start to reveal themselves. And it's really powerful that
And
what two people together can solve. Yeah.
it's for me, that's been the power of wise women is I don't even know what I don't know, but the women are so incredible and amazing. And I have so many women that I want to engage, and I just need to fill out the rubric and get them in because you just don't know what you don't know, and it's not like you have to have a goal. It's just it just happens organically, and I think that's the other thing is sometimes, and it's easier for me to say this to my kids because I've been through this whole life's journey, but to say, you know, you don't have to know what you're doing 10 years from now because what you do now is going to influence what you do tomorrow and the next day. And it took me a long time to learn that. But looking back on it, you realize, yeah, everything really did happen for a reason.
Yeah. And you followed your gut and you took big risks, and look where you are now. You're living the dream. You're in the place that you want to be in. You're in the right place.
Working a little too hard, though. So we're talking
Okay.
now about, even though I've only been in this job 2 years, we are talking about the next chapter, which I know wise women will be there for me when I start exploring this next chapter.
Awesome. Well,
You
on
are the
that
best.
note,
Thank you
yeah.
so much.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. And listeners, if you enjoyed today's interview, please subscribe below so you'll be alerted when other interviews are published. If you have any questions for me or for Susie, I'll post this interview on my website, lifestorycurator.com, under the blog section. And then I'll also post, if you're okay with that, Susie, your LinkedIn information and your information on how to get in touch with you at the Anti-Defamation League. To see if someone is interested either in donating or maybe contributing in some way to the great work that you're doing. So,
So
on that
much.
note, I'll say
Hope
stay safe, stay
so
well, and let's keep sharing those stories. Have a great day.
too. Thank you.